Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode contains material that may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
When the police entered the sand pit and started to investigate the scene, there were a few things that they saw immediately. There were many curious details about the crime scene.
On August 21st, 1971, a disturbing scene was uncovered in a sand pit where the lifeless bodies of two young women were discovered, the victims of a gruesome murder. The crime scene bore distinct features, like the victims' shoes being carefully removed and neatly placed beside them.
Whoever had murdered them had placed the girls side by side, their shoes, placed them beside them, covered the bodies with plastic sheet. Why? That was not clear at the time. It was clear from the start that these were the missing girls.
The investigators soon connected the dots, recognizing the girls as the missing hitchhikers whose disappearance had already baffled the community for some time. However, a haunting question remained. What had happened to them?
There weren't enough bruises that they would have caused their death, so it was something else what had done to them.
The case got more and more complex as these two victims shared striking similarities with another woman, also a hitchhiker, whose tragic end had previously been discovered.
Because of these similarities in crime scenes, they began to thought that maybe this was the same suspect who killed all the girls.
The suspect, whom investigators would eventually focus their attention on, would turn out to be a profoundly disturbed individual. This man would prove to be a formidable challenge, even for the dedicated woman appointed to defend him in court.
The guys in Finnish Center for Legal Protection told me that this is a very easy case because he's obviously mentally ill and they are going to send him to mental examination, so it's probably one session. That was really not the case.
He was narcissistic and he invented stories and lots of stories.
And I was his defense lawyer, so there were threats of killing me and so on.
You are listening to Nordic Crimes, The Hitchhiker Murders.
Kierrättämiseen.
The summer of 1971 in Finland buzzes with vibrancy. Helsinki hosts the European Athletics Championship. Rock festivals dominate, and the youth immerse themselves in pacifism and the hippie movement. Hits like Yellow River by Christie fill the airwaves. Across the country, young adventurers hitchhike, some in search of new experiences, others simply commuting. This era also marked a turning point for young Finnish women. The country had recently legitimized abortion for women over 17, and by 1971, the imminent arrival of home pregnancy test kits was the talk of the town. With new laws against gender discrimination in jobs, women in Finland were entering a more equal world. On a bright day, July 11th, 1971, 23-year-old Salme Metsänikula was immersed in the joy of celebrating her mother's 60th birthday at her childhood home in Umeliokki, which is now a part of Kuvula. Back in the day, it was a quaint town of just 1,400 residents. Among her siblings, Salme stood out. Being the eldest, she received the generosity and privilege of her parents' financial support for education. Their investment bore fruit when she became one of the top 40 students in her school, graduating in 1968. Following her graduation, Salme was driven by a wanderlust uncommon among her peers. She saved diligently and took up work at a Kodak factory in Sweden. With her multilingual abilities, she later embarked on a journey to study English in the bustling city of Turku. Maybe she wanted to study English in the summer university, so in the future she could go and live somewhere abroad. We can only imagine the hopes and dreams of a 23-year-old in the summer of 1971, when she's leaving her mother's birthday party and going back to her university in Turku. She doesn't have a car, so she's planning to take a bus to Kurja, which is only 20 kilometers from her parents' home. From there, she plans to hitchhike to her final destination. Salme never makes it to Turku. Her friend and ex-roommate tries to knock on her door for 3 weeks before sending a worried letter to her parents.
I recently sent a letter to Salme, which was returned here because she wasn't home. I'm writing to you because I don't know Salma's whereabouts at this moment. Every day I have tried to contact her, but in vain. I am a little worried about where she must be. If you know where she is, I would love to know the address.
When Salma's parents get the letter, they are horrified. Her father leaves for Turku immediately, and when he finds out that his daughter is in fact missing, August 11th, 71, he goes to the police station to report his missing daughter.
I am Miika Viljakainen, crime journalist and an author. You have to understand that during the 70s, there were no mobile phones, and people usually got in touch with letters, especially Salme's parents, who were quite old. They did not have a phone in their home, and they could not reach Salme via phone and did not phone her during that time when she went back to Turku.
Salme had been particular about who she hitchhikes with, because there were risks in hitchhiking.
Of course, there were risks in hitchhiking, since if you think about the situation, especially if you are alone at the side of the road and someone comes to pick you up and you enter their car, and if the driver has some bad intentions, of course, there were lots of violence and crimes that happened, but that is because the hitchhikers were easily available for different kinds of criminals.
Hitchhiking was commonplace due to its popularity, making hitchhikers an easy target for predators. While hitchhiking was seen as a regular means of transport, female hitchhikers often faced dangers that were met with public blame. This reflects the mindset of the 1960s, when certain fashion trends, like the miniskirt, popularized by supermodel Twiggy, were unfairly linked to victim blaming in cases of assault.
Yeah, that was kind of a hypocrite. It's not even an exaggeration if I say that at the time, the woman who hitchhiked and especially women who hitchhiked alone were seen as sluts.
And the hypocrisy didn't end there. Men who owned a car were warned about vile women who would trick men into giving them a lift and then doing something crafty.
And there were lots of these kind of fantastic rumors about these kind of women who hitchhike. And when they get into a man's car, they began to scratch themselves. And with that, they are going to extort money from the driver and accuse the drivers that they are trying to rape them. That was bullshit. I have never seen a court case about these things, but I have seen numerous court cases where the driver has tried to rape the hitchhiking woman or even killed a hitchhiking woman. Women were seen guilty of what happened to them during those hitchhiking trips, at least at some level.
In the 1970s, festivals drew many young people and the roads were dotted with hitchhikers. At this time, the hippie movement was sweeping through Finland. While some young folk were attracted to the hippie fashion, others dove deep into its culture, exploring new music, experimenting with mind-expanding substances, and breaking away from traditional societal norms. One major festival that attracted attention was Roisrock, dubbed the Northern Woodstock. Its debut the previous year saw a turnout of 38,000 people, and expectations for 1971, set to begin on August 20th, expected to reach 100,000 attendees. Among the excited festival goers were two inseparable 17-year-olds, Ritva Rajas and Pirjo Laiho. The pair joked about spending their lives together, imagining a future as lifelong companions. During the weekdays, they lived together at Ritva's mother's home in Hyvinkää, a town about 50 kilometers north of Helsinki. While Ritva worked in Helsinki, Pirjo occasionally visited her parents in Espoo, about 60 kilometers away. On August 14th, a week before Roisrock, Ritva wrapped up her shift in Helsinki and planned to meet her mom in the evening. Pirjo, visiting her parents, packed some borrowed vinyl records in her red and white plastic Snoopy bag. Ritva and her aunt initially planned to drive and pick Pirjo up, but a change in plan saw the aunt suggesting they opt for a bus or train. The bus or train schedules didn't match with the girls' plans, so they decided to hitchhike instead. "Nothing will happen to us. There are two of us," they assured Ritva's aunt. By evening, Ritva's mother grew anxious as the girls hadn't returned for their movie night. Learning of their hitchhiking plan, she held on to hope that they were simply running late. But as hours turned to morning with no sign of the girls, panic set in. After a futile search, they reported the girls missing on August 16th, with the police formally registering the case the next day. On August 18th, a warm summer day, a Helsinki man went mushroom hunting with his family near Inkoo, about 50 kilometers southeast of Helsinki. While his focus was on the ground, searching for mushrooms, a decision to venture deeper into the woods would change the day's course.
And when he entered woods and went further, first he saw that there was a skull lying on the ground. And when he went closer, he saw that there was the whole skeleton under this moss and twigs and that kind of leaves.
The discovered body wore remnants of blue jeans and had a broad black leather belt around its waist. The man informed his wife of his find and then sought a phone booth. After fishing out 2 coins, he dialed the emergency number. Then he called a journalist friend, Hannes Markula, sensing a scoop he wouldn't want to pass up.
Ilta Sanomat Magazine, the 19th of August, 1971. Altogether, there are 15 men investigating the body. They say it's a woman, a young woman, approximately 160 centimeters tall. The preliminary investigation doesn't reveal any injuries on the body. However, it is clear that the body was buried intentionally and hidden with small branches.
After breaking this story, the journalist earned a lifelong moniker, Murder Markula. Near the body, investigators found a pair of shoes, arranged neatly. Preliminary deductions surmised the body had laid there for quite some time, given only skeletal remains and clothing fragments were left. Lifting the remains, the team found a pair of women's glasses underneath. After Hannes Markula's story hit the newspapers, Salme's former roommate read the account of a 160 centimeters tall female with contemporary large glasses and jeans. Even though the identity wasn't confirmed, she had a gut feeling it was Salme. The following day, Sunday, August 15th, a young maid chose to cycle near Soitula, an under-construction site for the new Helsinki-Vantaa airport, during her day off. Prisoners had been working there since the 1950s. She cycled past an unmistakable scene.
This young maid was cycling on a road and saw that there were some kind of baggages on the side of the road, and she decided to check what was in there. It was this kind of a bag which had a picture of Snoopy from Peanuts on it. And she discovered that in the bag there were these kind of vinyls in there. And she also saw that in that area there were lots of other stuff like ripped photographs and stuff like that. It looked like that somebody had just thrown their stuffs all around the roadside.
5 days later, on Friday, August 20th, the same maid was reading the newspaper when she happened upon a piece about 2 missing girls, one of whom was described in detail. She immediately contacted the police. Investigators scoured the area where the Snoopy bag was located, uncovering more items tied to the girls. Ritva's purse, a towel with floral patterns, and torn Polaroid photos. They clung to the hope that they'd find usable fingerprints, a pivotal clue for investigators in the 70s.
The fingerprints have been a tool for crime investigation. I can't even remember how long. But at the time, they had a massive register of fingerprints that were collected, for example, from former inmates. And of course, at the time, fingerprints, they were, well, accurate, but there weren't this kind of computers that would make this work fast. So when they found a fingerprint, that was a very slow process to try to find a match for it.
By Saturday, August 21st, a group of young men in Hyvinkää prepared for a shooting practice at a landfill. But a foul smell made them reconsider, so they headed to a nearby sandpit. On arriving, signs of prior activity became evident. After some exploration, a harrowing discovery was made.
Hey, there are bodies there!
Ritva and Pirjo's bodies.
When the police entered the sandpit and started to investigate the scene, there were a few things that they saw immediately. There were many curious details about the crime scene. The girls were in a ditch, but they were covered with the plastic blanket. They were fully clothed, but for the other girl, her panties were pulled down, and there were some bruising on the bodies, but it was apparent that there weren't enough bruises that they would have caused their death, so it was something else what had done to them. When compared to Salme Metsänikola's disappearance, Salme was only a skull and skeleton, so they couldn't be conclusive about the identity of Salme right away. But when they found Pirjant Ritva in the ditch, it was clear from the start that these were the missing girls. It's kind of morbid to say, but the bodies stayed rather fresh under the plastic sheet. So it was not immediately clear how long the girls had been dead. It was assumed that they had died during the day they disappeared, but that was not conclusive. And one curious detail on the crime scene was that the girls' shoes were taken off and they were put aside, like when you enter your home and you take your shoes off. That was kind of a detail that struck the investigators, that whoever had murdered them had placed the girls side by side, their shoes, placed them beside them, covered the bodies with plastic sheet. Why? That was not clear at the time.
Upon examining the body found earlier by the mushroom picker, authorities deduced it was Salme Metsänikola.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Items near the body and a report from Salma's father helped confirm the identity. With newspapers already running stories, the authorities quickly informed the Metsänikola family. Near Salma's body, a bus ticket traced her journey from Umeljoki to Koria, a town less than 15 kilometers away. From there, they deduced Salma might have hitchhiked. A ripped notebook belonging to her was found in a nearby well. The location, an old work camp known to employ prisoners. Could an ex-prisoner be involved?
Before the police started to work on the fingerprint, they had an idea that the suspect may be a former prisoner. There were lots of reasons to suspect that. For example, Pirjo and Ritva were found near Seutula airport area, and that area was constructed by inmates at the time. And there were also this kind of connection in the woods where Salome Metsänikula was found. A few years back there was this kind of a not prison, but working site for prisoners. And so these two crime scenes had this kind of inmate connection, so they started to check who had been prisoner in there and there, and checked all the registers from that perspective. Could they find a match?
The postmortem of Ritva and Pirjo yielded evidence. Sperm was found on Ritva, though the timing, before or after death, remained uncertain. Both had endured clear trauma. After extensive tests, the cause of death was determined. Carbon monoxide poisoning.
When you are killing someone with carbon monoxide, it is quite clear that it is not an impulse, like strangling would be an impulse. Stabbing someone would be an impulsive act, but not this kind of thing that you are creating circumstances that you are able to kill someone with carbon monoxide poisoning.
Both girls had consumed alcohol, as revealed by their blood samples. They likely drank after leaving Ritva's aunt and before their demise.
The most important thing of this particular crime was that they could link these two cases together. Salome Metsänikula in the woods. In Salome Metsänikula's scene, there were also this shoeing. The shoes were taken off from the corpse. And this also happened with Pirjo and Ritva. Because of these similarities in crime scenes, they began to thought that maybe this was the same suspect who killed all the girls.
The tragic fate of three young hitchhiking women became a central narrative in Finland in August 71. Publications cover the story extensively, urging readers to come forward with any knowledge about their final journey. The police distributed pamphlets detailing their appearances, outfits, and belongings. Both Ritva's and Pirjo's pamphlets, as well as Salme's, contained a description.
People who have given them a lift or know anything about their whereabouts on the day they disappeared are asked to contact the National Bureau of Investigation at telephone 121.
The pressure for investigators to publish the pamphlets was understandable. They were working against time.
In a crime investigation, the time is the essence. The longer the time, the more difficult it gets to solve the crime. It's kind of if you try to solve a puzzle, and when you have all the pieces, well, it's not easy. Even then, you have to get pieces right and to form the full picture. But if you leave the puzzle on a sidewalk and leave it there a couple of hours, some pieces go missing. Leave it a couple of days, terrain comes, washes some puzzle pieces away, and what's left after a couple of weeks? Really nothing.
Despite the frustrating stages in the investigation, the police finally have a breakthrough.
Eventually, the match with the fingerprint in the Polaroid picture is found. And from that point, it was clear that they probably had found their perpetrator.
The police have found their suspect, a 41-year-old man named Enzio Koivunen. Average looking, 174 centimeters tall, Ansu was described as a man whose appearance you couldn't describe 15 seconds later after seeing him on the street. Like the police originally thought, he was an ex-inmate with a criminal background of 15 years in total.
And he had a criminal history. He had been a burglar. He had these kind of crimes. He had no history of violent crimes, but at the time he was living in Helsinki, and it was known that he had a car and he was accustomed to make some longer trips around southern Finland. So it seemed apparent they had found their one and only suspect. And because the smoking gun in this case was the fingerprint in the Polaroid picture,
the police don't catch Ansu immediately, because he had gone fishing for the same weekend the police finally matches his fingerprint with the one they found on the Polaroid picture. The police finally takes Ansu Koivunen into custody on Sunday, August 26th.
When the police were searching Ansu's car, they found out that the back seat was full of dog hairs. And Ansu had a dog, white dog, called Bella. And why this is important, it's because they found white dog hair also from the clothes of Pirjo and Ritva. Pirjo and Ritva did not have a dog, so the one possible explanation was that Pirjo and Ritva had been in Ensio's car in his back seat, and the dog hairs were transitioned from the back seat into their clothing. So that was one of the possible keys to nail the evidence that would point that Ensio was the perpetrator and the murderer of the girls.
The police have two strong pieces of evidence: a fingerprint and dog hair. His cherished possessions, his white dog Bella and his white Dodge Dart from 69, are turning against him. But during a house search, the police find yet another crucial piece of evidence.
When police investigated Ensio's apartment, they found that there was a hidden camera in his linen closet. The camera was Kodak. That's important because that was one of the things that had gone missing from Salme Metsänikula's belongings. Salme had worked in a Kodak factory in the past years, and then camera was quite recognizable, and that was one of the things that had been reported missing from her belongings. And of course, Ensio denied that the camera would be the same camera that had been Salme's camera, but it was apparent that was just too much a coincidence.
Ensio's knack for conjuring excuses wasn't the only thing that perplexed the police. They soon realized he had a history of spinning tall tales about his life.
Ensio Koivunen was a petty criminal. He was narcissistic. He used to talk about a lot of all the women he had slept with. He had this kind of a personality trait that he wanted to brag about his adventures.
No one could pinpoint when Ensio began his fabrications, but his criminal history started in his teens, likely accompanied by a fair share of lies.
Originally, he was from Karelia area, and Karelia was lost to Russia during the war, and Ensio's family had to flee from Karelia to Middle Finland. And from the young ages, from when Ensio was a child, he had many problems in school. He did some burglaries, and eventually he moved to southern Finland and into Helsinki.
A year before his arrest, Ensio had married a woman with whom he owned a bar. Now, living in Kontula in East Helsinki, Ensio picked up odd jobs. He often referred to himself as a jack of all trades.
Ensio's wife was quite straightforward with her husband's goings. She told the police that Ensio had disappeared from time to time for many hours. Wife told the police that she had helped to clear the vomit from Ensio's car. Ensio had told her that he had given a lift some hitchhiking girl that had become nauseous and vomited in the car. Of course, that was quite interesting fact, since at the time police already knew that Pirjant Ritva had died of carbon monoxide poisoning. And one of the things that, what do you do when you are poisoned by something you throw up? Would that be a coincidence? Police thought, and more these kind of details gathered up and pointed towards that Ensio Koivunen was the murderer of these three girls.
Considering all the evidence gathered from Ensio's residence and car, the police believed he was the one who drove the girls. But as they prepared for the interrogation, they braced themselves for the challenges ahead.
In my opinion, the interrogations went to hell from the start. It's because Ensio was a narcissistic personality and he invented stories and lots of stories. Let's take an example that at the start he denied that he had ever seen the girls who were dead. He denied everything. But when the police presented some evidence that they already had, Ensio just changed his story and told that that the first stories he had told, they were all lies, but now he is going to tell the truth. And with this kind of method, Ensio kind of managed to make police chasing shadows.
Ensio's tales were so outlandish that they'd make even modern-day conspiracy theorists raise an eyebrow.
Ensio told stories about amnesia, about drugs, about unknown men who killed the girls. He told that he had a sex relationship with one of the victims and denied all again and admitted something and denied it later. And he just spun the stories over and over again.
Due to Ensio's wild tales, the police had to verify their truth. This was time-consuming. For instance, they had to test the remnants of a soda Ensio claimed contained drugs. It was clean. In an early interrogation, he said that upon offering the girls a ride, one of them made a provocative proposition out of gratitude. He denied her advances and mentioned meeting a beauty pageant winner with whom he had a rendezvous. On August 14th, when Ritva and Pirjo disappeared, he had parked near a mall, hoping to spot this lover. Police interviews revealed that Ensio often bragged about women's alleged advances towards him. When the investigators found the so-called lover, a 22-year-old, she remembered him for a sinister reason. He had assaulted her. It became evident that Ensio preyed on young women, but his motivations remained hazy.
During the investigation, time after time he had said that now I am telling you the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And when they went into the court, police had a massive material from the interrogations where Ensio had spun his stories all over again. Ensio had sent police chasing the shadows when the police tried to close the gaps in his stories. But Ensio changed the story so many times that it just became impossible. And I think police focused too much on that work. So when the court started, police did not have enough evidence towards Ensio Koivunen.
Come November 1971, magazines highlighted mental health, children's rights, and treatment for addicts. They also spotlighted upcoming Finnish elections. Environmental concerns grew, with newspapers featuring articles on conservation and workplace inequalities. Tips for improving open offices, like introducing music and ventilation, became popular. However, these comforts seemed distant dreams as the trial for the hitchhiking murders commenced on November 12, 1971.
When the court started, it's hard to imagine what the atmosphere was like when you are reading these articles from that time that described the atmosphere. It was kind of a circus. It was a farce. There were lots of curious people that were trying to get into the courthouse. There were people who thought that they knew the real perpetrator. There were dreamers. There were, of course, lots of press. There were lots of people in the courtroom on the starting day.
I am Paula Kukkonen, and in 71 I was an auscultant in the Court of Appeal of Turku.
Paula Kukkonen, fresh out of law school, sought opportunities in Helsinki's larger landscape. The Finnish Center of Legal Protection piqued her interest with a promising offer. They sought a young lawyer keen on research and litigation. The attractive salary and benefits led her to accept the position, starting on September 13, 1971. Shortly after joining the company, she was handed a most significant case, the hitchhiking case, defending the accused, Ensio Koivunen.
If I would have known as much as I know today when I was 77, I might have considered. But at that time, I was fresh, blue-eyed, very innocent country girl. So I had no prejudice. And also the guys in Finnish Center for Legal Protection told me that this is a very easy case because he's obviously mentally ill and they are going to send him to mental examination, so it's probably one session. That was really not the case. First of all, we had not got enough documents to the first session, so we had to ask for more time to get acquainted with the case. And also, I was young and I was eager and I wanted to be as good as possible and get acquainted thoroughly with the case. So I read all the documents very, very thoroughly. And I had some, of course, help with the guys from the center. And then I also thought that my young age and my inexperience should not be in the way that he could not get the possible, best possible legal aid. And there has to be a fair trial. When you're young, you don't think so much about your age. You think that you have been qualified for a profession and you try to be as good as possible. You try to be serious and as thorough as possible. And as I was a young lady, I had to be more thorough than a guy would have had to be.
Despite Paula's vast experience in court from her role as a trainee district judge at the Court of Appeal, she was unprepared for the challenges of such a high-profile case like this one.
He was difficult because he changed his stories from time to time. The first meetings were not very difficult, but then when he got on and on, then he started to change all kind of stories. And that's what the police also said, that he had changed his stories. But one of the interesting things were that he never confessed anything to me. And I was his defense lawyer, so I could not say confess on behalf of him. And there were only indications, there were not direct proof of him killing the ladies. Because, for instance, from Metsä Nikula, you could never say what she died in. The forensics could not say what was the cause of death. And then about Rajas and Laiho, it was also for me difficult to understand how he could have one man who was not a big man. How could he have dealt with two girls at the same time? Girls who were not defenseless. They had practiced judo and so on. So the description how the prosecutor said that it would all have happened was not really trustworthy to me. So that's why I wanted to turn every stone and try to find out what was really the truth. And still there are many questions which are unanswered in this case.
Right from the start, Paula didn't just focus on the menial tasks that society expected women to do during that era. The media was ecstatic. They now had a story about a young female lawyer defending an alleged murderer.
I could feel that kind of hatred was the atmosphere around the court and around me. They wrote all kinds of things and very much about my personality, that I was very young, I was like a fairy, and they wrote about my hairstyle, my dresses and my hobbies. I thought that as I was parachuting, and people were very aggressive towards me also. And somebody said that next time you do parachuting, I hope that you'd fall down, and so on. So there were threats of killing me and so on.
One lingering question was, how did NCU use carbon monoxide to kill the girls? While it's evident that Ritva and Pirjo were poisoned, detectives were puzzled about the logistics. Their experiments with channeling exhaust fumes into a car didn't produce fatal levels of the gas. They speculated that NCU might have forced the victims to directly inhale from the car's exhaust. But this raised another question. What was one girl doing while the other was being poisoned? The prosecutor deduced that one must have been incapacitated first. Despite all the leads, NCU's silence and changing tales didn't help. And the dog hair found on the victims, thought to be from NCU's dog Bella, wasn't conclusive evidence for the court.
The Finnish police did not have technology to investigate the dog hairs thoroughly, so they sent the hair samples to Sweden. And in Sweden, they found out that the dog hair in the girl's clothing and in the backseat of Ensio's car were the same as Bella's. So that was the key point. Now it was clear that at least Pirjo and Ritva had been in Ensio's car. But what was not yet clear, that if Ensio had killed them on purpose.
The case's twists and turns didn't stop there. Paula found herself overwhelmed with the case, its media attention, and her demanding employer. Her association with this trial drew clients to her, many with criminal records. Plus, Ensio's unpredictable behavior and demands became challenging to manage.
It was frustrating, of course. And I tried to press him. And we talked and talked and talked. And then at some point, wanted to leave the case and leave Mr. Koivunen because he wanted to have new witnesses. And I thought that we had turned every stone. We had all these witnesses, which we could probably reasonably use. And I think the case was ready to be left for the court to decide. But he asked that we had to take new and new witnesses, but there was no added value, as I saw, in new witnesses. And then I said that we could not trust each other. And so I asked the court to release me from this case. And that's what they did.
Paula's departure from the case didn't make things any smoother.
After Paula Kokkonen left, the case just became a mess. Complete mess. Ensio Koivunen didn't trust his new lawyer either, and his story just went on and on and on and on.
Even before Paula's exit, Ensio had been pointing fingers at his ex-wife, alleging conspiracy. Psychiatric assessments identified him as a narcissistic psychopath, but noting that he was completely clear-headed during his crimes. And Ensio made sure Paula would remember him for a long time.
Oh yes, he wrote to me from prison and he wanted some witnesses to be interviewed. And then I wrote a very short letter back, but I wrote it, sent it through his defense lawyer at that time, who was Alexander Schichmann, because I thought that I will not discuss directly with him. But then I didn't get any answers after that. But I sometimes thought that, let's see, is he going to knock on my door when he gets out? But that never happened. No, I was not afraid of him. I didn't think that he could possibly do anything for me. And there was no reason.
After stepping away from the case, Paola embarked on a distinguished career, working in esteemed health institutions and eventually serving in the Finnish parliament. The court, after her exit, postponed the hearing to January 1973. By then, Ensio would have new legal representation, but his behavior remained unchanged. He continued to demand new witnesses and cross-examine them. After extensive hearings and deliberation, the court was ready with its verdict.
District court gave the verdict and saw that Ensio Koivunen purposely killed these three hitchhiking girls. And with the verdict also stated that Ensio had kidnapped girls and raped one of them. So he was convicted for prison for life.
Ensio, alongside his lawyer, then appealed the decision.
Court of Appeal verdict was that there weren't enough evidence to convict Ensio of homicides. It was clear that the girls had died when they had traveled with Ensio Koivunen, but there was not enough evidence to show that he had killed them purposely. So Ensio Koivunen was convicted of this kind of negligent homicide instead of murder. And the verdict was that he was sentenced to 25 years in prison instead of life sentence.
For Mika Viljakainen, the appellate court's ruling was just.
With that kind of evidence, I think there was no other way to convict otherwise. Police had done the groundwork very good, but during the interrogations, they just went straight to hell. There were lots of pieces missing. Not even today, we do not know the way Ensio Koivunen killed these girls. It's apparent that he killed these hitchhiking girls. It cannot be a coincidence that you are giving a lift to three girls and every one of them dies. That's just impossible that they would all be a coincidence. In my opinion, it's clear that Ensio Koivunen was a serial killer. But when we are in the courtroom, it's all about evidence. What can you show that has happened? And in that day when they were showing the evidence in the courtroom, the evidence just was not enough.
For Paola, a verdict is final. While she doesn't dwell on the case's rights and wrongs, she has, over the years, gained deeper insights into her client's psyche.
He was a sad guy, and some of those who made the forensic psychiatric examination said he was a psychopath. So maybe at that time I didn't know enough about psychopaths and so on. Then when I had been chairing and sitting as a member and afterwards chairing the forensic medical sessions in National Board of Health, I did understand quite a lot more about psychiatric cases.
So after understanding now more, do you think those kind of features would fit into Mr. Koivunen?
Oh yes. And that was also stated by the forensic psychiatrists at that time.
Ensio Koivunen never confessed to the murders. He always portrayed himself as the victim, insisting he'd only ever tried to help. Released in 1995, he passed away in 2003, aged 72. Many questions remain, some of which might have been answered with modern investigative technology. His motives, too, are shrouded in mystery. Although his criminal record spanned 15 years, it had no prior violent offenses. Some speculate that his prison stint may have nurtured his aggressive tendencies. He's now classified as a psychopathic serial killer, one of a mere dozen in Finland's history. Mika Viljakainen believes Ensio's modus operandi, coupled with evidence from the crime scenes, point to premeditation. We do know one rape victim preceding the murders, and possibly more given the stigma around reporting rape. In the end, everything about Ensio, from his behavior to psychiatric assessments, indicates his lack of remorse. He wasn't sorry for the crimes, just that he got caught.
This episode was written and reported by Marika Honkatukia. The script consultant was Eli Salo. Producer and sound designer was Suvi Tuli Kataya. Narrated by Tova Valnay. Executive producer is Nils Bergman. The primary resource for this episode's material is a book by Mika Viljakainen and Lauri Sylvander titled Hitchhiking Murders. Nordic Crimes is a Tall Tale production. Please rate, review, and recommend the show to friends. Your support helps us reach listeners who might also appreciate the content. Thank you in advance.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.